2FM.
Well, a big thanks to the two Johnnies for keeping us entertained this afternoon. It is Wednesday, July 19th, the eve of the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup. I'm Shane Dawson, you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and 7pm, Conan Byrne and Mary Curtin will be previewing the big one tomorrow as Ireland kick off their World Cup campaign at 11am. Against host Australia. Nadine Doherty will be reflecting on a bumper weekend of ladies football quarterfinals with Aoife Murray joining us to look ahead at the Camogie semis. The three wise men of golf journalism will be dialing in from the Open in Liverpool with Greg Allen, Doug Ferguson and the BBC's Ian Carter joining us very shortly. All that plus the latest news headlines makes up the show. If you want to have your say, drop us a text on 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Yes, hello there. Good evening. You're very welcome along to Game On. Lots to get through this evening. Nadine Doherty, a very happy World Cup Eve to you.
Thank you very much.
You excited?
I'm very, very excited. And I live close to Ringsend, and I presume you've seen the pictures.
Abby Larkin's house.
Oh,
and
you should, not her house, like the whole village is just bunting, flags, pictures of Abby. And I was down there this morning, I was picking up some dry cleaning and I was down doing a bit of an exercise class, and the buzz about the place and just chatting to people, and they're so proud of her, Shane, like it's just unbelievable. And I heard that a group in the community went round and collected €5 off all the residents in Irishtown and Ringsend, put it all together and just decorated the place. So I'd say to people, if you have time this evening, take a spin down there because it's absolutely class. And yeah, I can't wait for the morning. I actually have a code for Taylor Swift tickets, so I'll be on the ball there.
Big day ahead.
Big day ahead. But yeah, I just can't wait for it to get going now. And listen, the minute I leave here, I'll be running back to the telly with the documentary and the preview. And I was chatting to Alan Cawley earlier and everybody's buzzing. So yeah,
absolutely.
It's brilliant.
Alan Cawley will be with Rebecca Cray and our host Marie Crowe in the Roadcaster tomorrow morning. They're on air from 10:30 at Temple Oak United. So if you're in the Temple Oak area, get down, say hello to them. So yeah, it is going to be great. Cannot wait for it. We're going to be previewing it in detail with Conan Byrne and Mary Curtin in a few moments' time. But Conan Byrne, if I come to yourself first, and before we chat World Cup, let us chat European football. Shamrock Rovers out of Champions League contention yesterday. And I suppose I'm going to put a question to you that you posed on Twitter, and that has garnered nearly 25,000 views, loads of comments, and created a bit of discourse. Do we admit that Breda Blick are just a superior team to Shamrock Rovers, or are there serious questions to answer regarding the quality of players in our domestic league to compete in European competition? You mentioned it was the former for you, but after engaging in a bit of online discussion, are you still of that opinion?
Absolutely, Shane. Yeah, I do think Breda Blick were just a better team over the two legs. Obviously disappointing that Champions of Ireland and how well they did last year, getting through to the group stages and kind of bowing out so early on the Champions League qualifying against a team that many expected Shamrock Rovers to win. But at the same time, when you're coming up against teams like this that are third in the Icelandic League, we're going to be obviously talking about Klaksvík now very shortly, who are doing very, very well in that Icelandic League, coming up against Ferencváros of Hungary, who dominated Shamrock Rovers last year. So it just goes to show that maybe we just don't know much about these other leagues that are playing at the moment. You look at the national teams and Iceland aren't doing very, very well at the moment. But with Breda Blick over the two legs, they were the much better side. Stephen Bradley mentioned how poor they were defensively for the goals, and they were really, really poor, especially the first one where the ball just went right through the middle of the pitch. You can't defend those types of goals, and even the defence being so far apart from each other, Pico Lopez just got beaten a little bit too easy, and by the time he was beaten, the defender was Dan Cleary was nowhere in sight, and it was an easy finish. So yeah, very, very disappointing to see Shamrock Rovers go out, but at the same time you have to put your hands up. Breda Blick were the much better side.
So no Champions League football this year for Shamrock Rovers, and the safety net was that there should be a route into the Europa Conference League, because they are due to face the losers of Ferencváros of Hungary and Faroe Island champions Klaksvík. However, there is a big, big shock on the card. So it was nil all from the first leg. Everyone just assumed, myself included, Ferencvaros with home advantage, a bit of European pedigree behind them as well, should have enough to defeat their Faroe Island opponents this evening. However, with 50 minutes played, it is 3-0 to Klaksvík. So as it stands, Ferencvaros will play Shamrock Rovers. And Conan, on current form, you would imagine that will be the end of European football for Rovers.
You would think so, Shane. Like, for Klaksvík to go 3-0 up out in Hungary is it's a massive shock, huge shock, and Ferencvaros supporters won't be too pleased this evening. And just to put it into a bit of context, as I said, Ferencvaros played Shamrock Rovers last year, and the game ended 4-1 on aggregate to Ferencvaros, a 4-0 victory in Hungary, and then Shamrock Rovers beat them in Tala 1-0. But yeah, just very, very disappointing to see that. It probably will be, if that's truth be told, Shamrock Rovers will face a very, very uphill task to defeat Ferencvaros next week over the two legs. But so it probably will be the end. So we'll be relying on the other teams then, to the likes of Dundalk and Derry City and St. Pat's, to keep us on the road for Europe this season.
Absolutely, all three of those teams in action tomorrow at 7:45, so I'll be chatting to Paul Corrie tomorrow to preview those matches in due course, and we'll be reviewing Australia versus Ireland, which is what we're going to be previewing now. Conan, you're staying on the line. Mary Curtin joins us as well. It is World Cup Eve. I'm very excited, and I know Nadine was earlier. Many people in the country are all bitten by the bug that is the World Cup. So, Mary, in terms of team news, the news this morning that Denise O'Sullivan will start. She is fit. That is beyond a huge boost for Ireland.
Yeah, thanks, Shane. So, very, very happy that Denise is okay to play. I hope she is, in fact, okay. A bruised bone isn't nice to play with, and so I do hope she is comfortable enough. I hope she is feeling okay. You know, it's one thing to be clear to play, it's another thing, how comfortable are you? So I just hope she's okay. I mean, Denise, it's never, you don't want to just pinpoint the same two players always, but like, it's true. Denise is such an important player for the team. Her experience, she, I think, has 12 years playing for her country, I think over 100 caps anyway, captain for her club in North Carolina Courage, huge accolades along the way in her time playing in Australia, America, Scotland, and of course many accolades in Ireland. She's been an MVP 2 years running in with her club in North Carolina Courage. But the type of player she is, so like, she's the engine in midfield. She makes a bad pass into a perfect pass the way she receives the ball in the half turn. And, she's 5 steps ahead at all times. She knows her next pass. She links up the play so well, and she knows how to keep the ball. There could be 3 players around her, and we've seen this against France, but 3 players around her and she gets out with the ball and plays a perfect pass. She just has this perfection pass to her name, and she makes every player around her so good and fill with confidence. So really, really good news for Ireland.
Absolutely. Conan, will Ireland positively embrace their underdog status ahead of their first ever game at a Women's World Cup?
Yeah, absolutely. But I'd like to think so. It's the first time they've ever played, these girls have ever played in this type of arena, over 80,000 fans. And you just hope that the occasion doesn't get to them. That's the one worry that I'd have. And obviously with Australia hosting it, there's some massive pressure on that team. But I think, like, a lot of the people that are discussing this World Cup are kind of playing down Australia's hopes a little bit. I actually think they'll do extremely well. Like, since November, they have beaten Sweden 4-0, Spain 3-2. They've ended England's 30-match unbeaten run, beating them 2-0, and then obviously beating France in their last warm-up game last week, where Mary Fowler came off the bench at half-time to put the winner in. And they've only one defeat in the last 10. Actually, it was against Scotland, the team that we obviously got we beat in the playoff to get to the World Cup. But Australia didn't have Samantha Kerr playing, and when you don't have Samantha Kerr playing, Australia doesn't turn into that magnificent side that you see on paper. But they have vast experience all over the pitch, Shane. Like the two in midfield, Cooney Cross and Katrina Gorey, they've started every game in 2023. And Gustafsson is a man that sees those two players as influential in terms of their midfield presence. He very rarely takes them off in games. And him himself, he's all about his three core principles that he wants his Australian team to play in this World Cup, and that's with pace, good pressing game, and also to utilise set plays. And Ireland will have to be on their guard, especially from set plays with this Australia team. But with the likes of Louise Quinn, Niamh Fahey, we have good strong defenders there. And even at the other end of the pitch, that's where we may sneak a goal, and that's probably what we'd be looking for. We want to silence that big, strong Australian home crowd, although hearing that there's going to be a lot of a big Irish contingent in the stadium, which is great. But the big battle as well that I'm really, really looking forward to is Ellie Carpenter at right back against Australia, against Katie McCabe. Two of the best players in the world coming up against each other, and that battle in itself will be really, 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 really interesting, Shane.
Mary Kona mentioned the stadium, and it is great that we have over 80,000 fans sold out stadium. I know you would have played 40,000 plus in Chicago against the USA during your time as an Irish international. How much is tomorrow about managing the occasion as it is against coming up a team that has a golden generation really hitting form at the on time?
Yeah, that's the thing, Shane. You know, it can be daunting, but you know, we're looking for Ireland to just remain calm, to soak up that pressure and just take it in their strides. Of course, it can be daunting, but I think, you know, the girls are all playing high level football now, different story 10, 12 years ago, but they will, you know, we would hope that they will soak up that pressure and that we can just stay calm and play our game. Australia will, you would hope that they will feel that pressure, you know, of being the host nation at a World Cup, and so you would hope that they would have that little bit of doubt also of Ireland having beaten them in the past. But as mentioned, you know, their manager is well adjusted now. He's been managing them since 2020. He's been building and building. He has got those recent wins, you know, that big one against England, France. But he has an impressive CV himself, previously managing in the men's game in Sweden and assistant coach for the US. So, you know, he's managed under Jill Ellis, winning two World Cups, you know, so that kind of experience. But it was interesting to see the mind games. I know he spoke to some Irish press just days ago and was speaking already about, you know, getting at Ireland and us conceding often in the last minute, so that's something he was targeting. But like that kind of mind games already, and you know, he's a very experienced manager, and you know, I just feel if we keep our cool, we'll be fine. But they have a very experienced side ahead of them, so it's going to be tough, of course. But I hope that Ireland's mentality as well is that we can stay calm and that we can just play our game and put the pressure on Australia being the host nation.
Yeah, Conan, do you think that Irish players will be able to block out that outside noise? I think as Mary said there, was the manager says he has identified critical weaknesses in the Ireland team that he plans to expose. The Swede confidently declared he knows the starting 11 he'll start with, what substitutions he's going to make and how to crack open Vera Powell's disciplined unit. He makes it sound very easy.
Yeah, but look, let's hope it's not that easy. And I think Vera was very clever in over the last number of years playing high-ranked teams. I think that was really, really important to develop this group of players. And just goes to show that they can put it up to the top. They've beaten Australia back in 2020, 3-2 in Tala Stadium. And so they know that they're capable of doing it. Sam Kerr was playing that day. A young Mary Fowler, 18 years of age, could have actually played for Ireland herself. Scored two goals on that day, and as I said, she scored the winner against France the other night. So he says he's ready to pick. He knows a starting 11. I'd be just interested if he'd throw Mary Fowler into the limelight, considering how well she's done over the last number of weeks. And But it's just, yeah, it's going to be a very difficult game. As I said, it's with that low block that Vera Powell really, really likes. And she says that she needs to play that low block in order for Ireland to win. So you're expecting the likes of Heather Payne, who has been an attacking player most of her career, to come in at that right back, right wing back position, and negate the threat of Steph Catley up that down that left hand side of Australia, which is again another huge battle. So those two wings are going to be really, really interesting to see how they get on. It's just the area that I'd kind of focus on would be the area, just the two tens that I think Australia will play. So I do think Sam Kerr or Caitlin Ford will drop in, and leaving one up top. And I think that's where Vera will have to decide who goes in that player. Does Megan Campbell go in Megan Connolly, should I say, does she go in and stop that threat? Or does Ruisha Littlejohn and Denise O'Sullivan pick the two of them up and just let Australia have the ball in the middle of the pitch and just sit back, defend, and just hope for that counter-attack? And like Mary said there's no better player in the centre of the park that for Ireland than Denise O'Sullivan on that half turn. And if she can break up play, get the ball to her in that half turn, and then use our attacking threat, the likes of Sinead Farley, who's magnificently technical on the ball, and the pace of Caruso up front, you just never know. But I would worry with the attacking threat that Australia have in abundance, how we will be able to negate them for so long in the game.
First goal is going to be crucial, Mary, isn't it? We're going to want to try and suffocate them for as long as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, that's been the way Vera has set out, you know, from her time in charge. She has set out on that low block. We've seen her most recently change tactic a little bit, having that target player up top, Kyra Caruso, obviously, as we saw against France, doing unbelievably well up there. So yeah, like for me, you know, it's do we leave Megan Connolly back there? You know, I nearly prefer to see Diane Caldwell back there, given her experience. But I know Diane hasn't been in favour with her. Yeah, like it's that one against France. We obviously suffered in the sense that we had young players in on the wing back positions, and we just made those mistakes, and you just can't afford to make those mistakes, not against a firing Australia. So it will be very interesting to see if she remains with Megan Connolly back there. Look, at least in the first half against Zambia, we were firing, you know, and we were playing well. We were playing the most cohesive we've seen. So if that's the case, I hope that this is continuing, you know, in terms of the way we keep the ball, the way we keep possession. I do hope that we can just grow on that and play our own game too. I hope that we're able to possess, and I hope that we are able to build, just like we saw against the first half against France. So it will be interesting. I'm so excited. I'm looking forward to the game.
Absolutely, I cannot wait. Just to remind our listeners, you can listen to live commentary of Republic of Ireland versus Australia tomorrow in the Women's World Cup live on 2FM from 10:30, or you can watch live coverage on RT2 and the RT Player with kickoff at 11 a.m. The RT Sport website will also have a live blog of all the action. Mario, I'll be chatting to you tomorrow along with Paul Curry, reviewing hopefully what is a victory for the girls in green. Marie Curtin and Conan Byrne, thank you both very, very much. We're going to be chatting golf next.
Game on.
Golf.
Now, you're very welcome back to a Game On as we turn our attention to golf. And I mentioned at the start that the three wise men of golf journalism are on the line. RT Sports, Greg Allen, AP's Doug Ferguson, and the BBC's Ian Carter. Greg, I might just tee you up with one question and then let you have the floor with the two gentlemen beside you. Listen, lots of Irish interest in tomorrow. Rory McIlroy, of course, coming into it in good form. If he triumphs again, he'll be the first player to be presented with a claret jug for a second time in front of the iconic double-sided clock on the ivy-clad clubhouse. I suppose he's the favourite out of all of the Irish at the moment.
Yeah, and arguably he's the favourite going into it because of the fact that he won last week in the manner in which he won on Lynx turf in Scotland. And so who's a bigger favourite? is the world number one Scottie Scheffler a bigger favourite? You know, Scottie Scheffler is a consistent performing machine. He's got this extraordinary record that if he finishes in the top 12 this week, he'll have had 20 consecutive top 12 finishes in tournaments stretching back to last November. The world number three, John Rahm's, won four times this year, won two Irish Opens on Lynx courses, has been third in the Open Championship at Royal St. George's 2 years ago. So, I mean, like, they're the top three, and that top three in the world are separated in the world rankings by quite a distance from number four, Patrick Cantlay. But who's the real number four and five in the world? Brooks Koepka, Cameron Smith have to be candidates for being top three players in the world. Brooks Koepka, five-time major winner, second in the Masters, won the PGA. So, look, he's just, every time a major championship comes around, you cannot discount him. And obviously, Cam Smith with the putting stroke from heaven is perhaps one of the best contenders on any Lynx course, and he proved that last year with his final round to win the Open at St. Andrews. And this is a fascinating template for what's ahead of us in the next 4 days, I think. And I'm joined, as you said, by two very wise men, whatever about me. It's Doug Ferguson from Associated Press, who travels the circuit 20, 30 weeks a year, depending on how heavily the budget is spent by July, August, by the time you come to the FedEx Cup. And Ian Carter, BBC's golf correspondent for nigh on 20 years and does almost as much travelling. So firstly, we're all in this preamble just chatting about one player, and that's Rory McIlroy, for a number of reasons, because of the fact that he's up to world number two, he's back in form with that Scottish Open win last week, US Open, one shot, one place away from winning the fifth major that he so craves. Doug Ferguson, first I'm going to ask you, Rory McIlroy did not do a preview press conference at the US Open. He finished in second place. He did not do a preview press conference at the Scottish Open last week, which is a PGA Tour event as well as a DP World Tour event. He won it. It's a very unpopular strategy in the press room, I'm assuming, among the written press especially. Is it the right strategy for Rory right now, though? Because it seems to be working.
I don't think it is, and I'm not offended that he didn't talk. We can always get by. I just think it's a bad look. There's a responsibility that you have, and I frankly don't know why he didn't. We assume he didn't want to talk about any of the Saudi stuff. Maybe he didn't want to talk about, you know, the questions he's probably tired of answering is, why can't you win a major, or what's taken 9 years? Are you going to get it done this week? And that gets wearisome too. I don't know what is actually, unless someone talked to him and knows this stuff, but the fact is he didn't do it. You know, in a funny way, it always reminds me of guys who used to set out a red shirt on Sunday, and pretty soon they got paired with Tiger, and then they thought about it, said, gee, do I wear the red shirt or do I not? And the fact that they're thinking about it, they've already lost. I'm not suggesting that's it with Rory, but the fact that he's purposely taking his name off press conferences, which is what all the top players have done for longer than he has been at the BBC. It just makes you wonder if he's overthinking things.
And Tiger never did. You followed every bit of Tiger's career. Tiger never skipped a press conference before a major.
No, he never really said anything either, but that's not the point. We got to look at him, and they took pictures whenever he smiled, and that was all good fun. But no, Tiger never ducked anything in a major, unless it was later in his career and he was completely out of it on Saturday and no one really needed him anyway, but he always answered the bell.
So just to give some context to this, because this particular decision not to do a press conference, and it is a significant one, I know we're not going to over-obsess about it just because we're all media here, but the fact is that the week before the US Open, the story about the merger in the entity, whatever is going to happen in golf from 2024 onwards, broke at the Canadian Open, and he had to do that very difficult press conference at the Canadian Open because he was blindsided about that announcement. So the following week, he opted not to do the US Open press conference because it was basically too much for him. So that's kind of where it originated. But then the US Open went well, and then the Scottish Open went well. Is this really what he's kind of decided might just be a strategy short term until he wins his fifth major?
I just think it shows how wrapped up he is in what is becoming a bit of a crisis for him, that he isn't able to end this barren run in the majors, and he's trying every different thing. And I think that, you know, Doug said Tiger never said anything, but that doesn't matter. Well, actually, no, I disagree slightly. Tiger found a way to deal with all the attention that was on his shoulders, fulfill his obligations, and not let it derail him. And I think that Rory McIlroy is certainly bright enough to be able to come up with a form of words that would be able to deal with the questions that he finds so tiresome at the moment. One, you've not won a major for 9 years. Two, what do you think of what's going on with the Saudis? And he should be able to deflect those, come up with a form of words that doesn't generate headlines, doesn't add to the oppressive level of attention that is clearly on him, and fulfil his obligations to the public that ultimately consume what the media puts out there, and to the championship. You know, he's come here having won the most recent event on the DP World Tour and PGA Tour. He has come here as the player who won the last Open here. He should be able to talk for half an hour and be able to provide something out of that. And I genuinely feel that it was a dereliction of duty on his behalf. I'm not criticising him as an individual. I think it just paints that picture of how wrapped up he is in trying desperately to end that barren run.
Doug, is Rory McIlroy the player that we should be talking about right now as the favourite, or who do you think should be perhaps the man who will be the biggest rival to him, if that's the right way of putting it?
That is an interesting question, because Rory, to me, is the singular story this week. I think he's a bigger story than the links itself. You know, we always talk about the course we're coming to, but this is all Rory, and for all the reasons that Ian just mentioned. But to your question, I mean, I sit there and watch Jon Rahm, and I watch Scottie Scheffler, who's been nothing short of remarkable this year. And if you put them all on kind of peak form, who wins? I don't know. 5 years ago, you would have said Rory. I personally think right now Scottie Scheffler is the best player in the world. I know he's got the number one ranking, but even last week at the Scottish Open, he had an excuse. He had a nice reason to finish 30th, because he had just landed from the U.S. He had taken 2 weeks off, 10 days of not touching a club, and he still had a chance in the last hour. He's a great, great handsy. What I mean by handsy is he just knows how to score. He competes as well as anybody. He's long enough. The putting, as Scotty mentioned in his press conference, I think is getting a little bit too much attention. You know, one or two bad weeks and all of a sudden it's a thing. He's really, really good, and so is John. And, you know, to your point, you know, it is a pretty good drop down to the next group, but that next group is pretty good too. Rory is the story, certainly one of the favorites. Man, there's about six or seven guys that you could flip a coin.
Rory McIlroy, in your view, Ian, and I'm reporting on him all the time, you're reporting on him all the time, and we get close to, you know, what it is that drives him. The fifth major, which is obviously hasn't happened for 9 years, and the third major of his career happened here at this venue in Hoylake. The fourth major happened 3 weeks later in Valhalla in Kentucky, and now 9 years without this, you know, so craved for major. Is it too big a thing that we make of it, and that he has to do something like he's done this week, not talk to the media, to try and quell all the noise around it?
No, I think it's a huge thing for him. There's absolutely no escaping that fact, and it's clearly very, very oppressive. And you know, you look at, he had a chance a year ago at St Andrews, a very, very good chance at St Andrews, and was kind of passive on the final day. He had a great chance at the LACC at the US Open, and he was kind of passive on the final day. And back in the day, that kind of passive, mistake-free, relatively speaking, kind of golf was enough to get the job done for people like Nick Faldo, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, because they were seen as the players who wouldn't make the mistakes, and that would psychologically force mistakes out of the rivals on the leaderboard. It's not enough nowadays. The strength in depth that is on those leaderboards, the modern technology that is involved, the fact that mishits aren't as penalised as they once were, they all count against McIlroy if he's going to play that passive golf. So he has to go out and do what he did last Sunday in the Scottish Open. And I think that was a massive win and a potential turning point, because he was not playing well. He was being battered by the winds. He was overtaken, and he responded, and he went out there and he hit two of the greatest iron shots he's ever hit to make the birdies on 17 and 18 to win a title. And imagine if he hadn't won that. Another tournament he's gone in as the leader on the final round and not got the job done. What would the narrative have been all week long here? So it is a potential turning point, I think, last week.
Okay, so Scottie Scheffler is, in Doug's view, you know, the best player in the world right now. I think he's the best player in the world until he gets to about 8 feet from the hole. Who do you think then is Rory's biggest rival, if Rory is the favourite this week, or there or thereabouts?
I think Cameron Smith's a huge threat. I mean, he's got no pressure on his shoulders. Of course, he wants to win another Open. He's got that drive there, but he's in easy street on LIV. He's very happy with the way that his life is going, playing 14 tournaments a year, a ton of money in the bank, and he doesn't have any of the kind of angst and narrative around him that McIlroy does. And as you said, he's got that putting stroke from the gods, and he knows he can get it done on a links golf course. Seeing him, he was so chilled this week. I think he is a massive threat, undoubtedly. I agree with Doug with what he says about Scottie Scheffler. He can overpower the golf course, and I think, you know, the softer conditions as well, I think that brings a lot of Americans in who like to play that and are used to playing that target form of golf. But let's not forget, that's where Rory McIlroy plays his golf as well, and he plays target golf probably better than anyone.
So we're about 10 minutes into this discussion, and I've mentioned John Rahm, but neither kind of you have felt John Rahm is yet in that territory. Doug, John Rahm got off to the start of the year, 4 victories in the first 4 months, including the Masters, and he looked like he was going to be world number one with a Tiger-esque type of 18-point average or something like that by the time June or July came. But he hasn't. He's stalled. What's happened to John Rahm? Is he a contender, a real contender here?
I think he is. I think it, invariably you stall over time. We'll get it from Scheffler at some point. That's just the nature of the game. They were asking me the other day, you know, has anyone had a streak like Scotty? When's the last time that happened? And I said, John, last fall. If you remember, he was winning and finishing second and fourth, and he went 8 or 9 tournaments in a row. And I think if your name's not Tiger Woods, the game just leaves you for a little bit. I don't think he's too far away. I mean, I say Scotty, and every time I look at John, I thought, wow, he's just strong good. I mean, he's got his ball striking is immaculate, overpowering, same deal. Putting, you know, and the funny thing about putting is if you go back a year ago from, say, March through about May, John was getting the same questions then that Scotty's getting now. Oh, your putting is struggling. His putting was actually fine. They weren't going in. I know we need more explanation than that, but sometimes that's all it is in golf. And I chalk that down to John right now. He could turn up tomorrow and lights out, the John that we saw back in January, February, March, April.
Brooks Koepka, we always leave him last in this, and yet he should be first, really, shouldn't he? Because this is the guy who is the majors player over the last 6 years. 5 major championship victories, 2nd in the Masters, winner of the PGA, and just looks like the stud of the game again, the way that he carries himself.
Yeah, and I think people also forget his strategic powers, the coolness under pressure. And this is a strategic golf course. This is where you have to say, I'm leaving the driver in the bag here. I'm playing for position. That's my strategy. And I'm going to execute it in the way that Tiger did in 2006. And I think that Koepka does possess that mental strength. We saw the way that he bounced back from what was a punch in the gut at the Masters to win the PGA Championship. My only question is, you know, how well LIV prepares you for the majors. And, you know, and you can say that about Cam Smith as well. The reason I'm more in favour of Cam Smith is because he is trending. He won his last tournament out. He had to scrap for it as well. It was off the back of one very early brilliant round, and then he had to scrap it through, and that will give him a lot of confidence. But you're right to highlight Brooks Koepka. I mean, you cannot discount him in any way, shape, or form.
We're allowed 60 more seconds.
That said, and Brooks is great and can do it any week, but I'm trying to think if he's ever had a really good run on links golf. I know he can play it, but I'm not sure he's ever contended, has he?
He had a run, didn't he, in Port Rush, actually. He was reasonably prominent in Port Rush.
Yeah, but not challenging for the title, but he does love links golf. You know, one of his favourite tournaments to play is the Dunhill Links. You know, so he embraces it. And I think that's an important thing.
Okay, a strong runner and an outsider, Doug. And we know how much you love predicting.
Tyrrell Hatton.
As an outsider or as a strong runner? Because he could be both.
Better be an outsider on this one, because you guys will laugh at me again since I never get these things right. I'll stick with Scheffler for the outsider. I'm sorry, for the favorite.
I'll give you 2 strong runners. Ricky Fowler, in great form, and Tommy Fleetwood, who I think will really embrace and ride the huge support he's going to have.
Yeah, and of course Fowler was tied second here in 2014 with that run on the back nine that Sergio Garcia also managed. I'm going to say that I think Shane Lowry, and I know I'm sounding like I'm really hammering my colours to my flagpole here, but I really think Shane Lowry needs to break out of what he's broke, you know, this sort of top 20-itis that he has, nearly but not quite. He's got his putting back, I think. I watched him in practice. thought he looked really sharp, and I'm going to go for Rory. There you are. How utterly nationalistic can I be? But you know what? I actually do feel that they are two extremely strong runners. I also have this thing for Brian Harman. Keeps coming back into my head. I don't know why. I just have this feeling that Brian Harman's going to be a really, really strong. I think he was sixth last year, and he's a gritty competitor. Loves strategy. Anyway, there you go. There's the vote from the jury, from Ian Carter from the BBC. Doug Ferguson from Associated Press, and humble little me, Shane.
Humble little you, the three wise men, Greg. I'm having it. Three of the most wisest journalists on the circuit. Gents, thank you very much. Greg will be checking in tomorrow. Aoife Murray and Nadine Doherty are with me because there's some big, big news from the GPA that we'll be bringing you in just over 2 minutes' time.
Game on 2FM.
Hey, you're very welcome back to Game On. Shane Dawson here. Nadine Doherty is still in studio, and Aoife Murray joins us on the line now. Because while we were just coming on air, the GPA released a statement, and it is huge news for female intercounty players. It is a statement on behalf of the female intercounty players. The statement reads: following constructive meetings between the GPA and the Ladies Gaelic Football Association, and separately between the GPA and the Camogie Association over the course of the last week, a framework has been agreed to deliver a standardised charter for female intercounty players for 2024. Therefore, we, the players, have decided to suspend our protest actions ahead of the weekend's matches. Commitments are now in place from the two national governing bodies as follows. One, agreement by the NGBs to collaborate with the GPA on the development of a player charter for 2024. Two, agreement from the NGBs to request funding support from the GAA or the charter implementation independent of the GPA. Three, agreement that any approach, should it be necessary, to government for funding will be undertaken jointly with the GPA. All protest actions on match days are now suspended with immediate effect. Players will also return to taking part in media events organised by the Camogie Association and the LGFA. We thank the Camogie Association and LGFA for their commitment to implementing a standardised player charter for 2024. We also thank the GAA for their commitment to support the initiative. This is a landmark moment in our games and for women's sport in Ireland. Aoife Murray, if I come to you first, I'm sure this is music to your ears.
Yeah, look, it is. To be honest, I'm just so happy for the players that they can actually, for the next couple of days, particularly those that are playing this weekend, can actually now go and concentrate on what they want to do, and which is play the game. And I think it's, albeit the protest happening for the last number of weeks, it has been a long time coming. I think if you look back to even earlier in the year, and you know, between Kildare and Cavan and the issues with the voluntary player charter, it just showed that model didn't work. As I've said in the last couple of weeks, I'm so proud of how the players have carried themselves through this. I think it also shows just how committed I think both players on LGFA and Camogie side are to bettering this game. And as I've said before, this, for some in this generation of players, may never actually fully get the impact of what a player's charter is, but they're doing this for the generations to come. And I think there's something quite nice, the fact that this has come out as well on the eve of our women's soccer team playing in the first World Cup tomorrow. And you think back to them, and we still remember the pictures from 2017, you know, sharing tracksuits. I still remember that heading to 21 when they got the C parity, to now on the eve of the first time of having a women's team in the World Cup. I think there's something very nice about that timing, Shane. And I think it just really goes back to point why the players are now fighting for minimum standards. That's exactly what our colleagues in the Irish soccer team were fighting for, minimum standards. Look what they have achieved since they've started getting some level of investment down to the parity of the performance. So to me, I think it's perfect timing of why this was so important, and I'm just so happy the players can now go and concentrate on playing the game.
Yeah, if I echo all of your sentiments there, and I was thinking the exact same thing. What timing, like, you know, what a 24 hours for Lady Sport. I suppose on Monday, when the GPA and Tom Parsons indicated protests would be suspended, I didn't think there'd be white smoke this soon. And literally when we sat down, the piece of paper came in. So it's just amazing, and huge credit, absolutely, as you said, Aoife, to the players. You know, they're trailblazers, and they won't know, I suppose, the impact that they're going to have for years and years to come. And that's pretty incredible. And you know, being a teacher, I know that we'll be telling young girls, and there'll be books about this down the line, and they've really changed the course of history in 2023. And listen, credit as well to the associations, you know, the LGFA and the Camogie Association. And I agree, it has been such a long time coming. I mean, historically, you know, the LGFA is 50 years this year, but you know, 5 weeks of protests, it's great that it only took 5 weeks. And I don't mean that, I'm not demeaning 5 weeks, but it's amazing, and I'm so happy that it's happening now, because again, I thought it would be dragged out longer. So fair play to everybody for getting around the table. It's brilliant. And obviously the GPA in facilitating meetings and so on. And it's great that they are going to request funding from the GA, and I hope they go to the government as well, because women in this country and female athletes, they play a huge role in society. And you know, when Tom Ryan publicly committed to that support, the LGFA and the Camogie Association now have that pathway in there. So I really hope they do take it up, because again, it'll be another step in the way to integration. And I suppose that'll bring us on, and we may not have time to talk about it, but you know, the steering committee statement today, there's just so much positivity. And that steering committee statement about the study that they're going to do, listen, it's all really positive. But just to come back to it, the players, well done to every single one of them out there, and I wish them all the very best in their new journey forward as female athletes in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Just on that steering group integration statement that was released before the GPA statement, so the Gaelic Games Association's steering group on integration, the SGI, has commissioned a landmark research study to gauge the opinions of members to assist in developing the pathway to integration. The steering group is working towards the establishment of this pathway by February 2024, chaired of course by Mary McAleese. The study has the potential to be one of the largest of its kind ever carried out in Irish sport. Among other questions, it seeks to establish what benefits do members feel will arise out of this project from an organisational point of view and an individual and personal perspective. What challenges or issues are members concerned about? What priorities should be the focus after integration? So again, Aoife, you know, it's following in this positive vein.
Look, it is, and I think by going down to the grassroots and actually asking the grassroots, look, in many ways, and I hate to go negative, you know, within their listening period of 2020. Two, it would have been a great place to have started with the grassroots, because there is the one club model that's already in place, Shane, which goes across a number of clubs across the 32 counties. So the good thing about getting this research now is there's actually live data of integration at grassroots level. So you would like to think that that should highlight the positives, the negatives, what worked well, what hasn't worked well, and what were the issues that they got over, or what are the issues that are currently there. So I think it's a massive piece of research, and the fact that we have that live data from that one club model, you would like to think that that could even point to a one county model on our way to actual full integration and a new Gaelic Games body. So look, it is absolutely positive. I would just love to keep this momentum going now, and that's probably the biggest call that I would have.
Yeah, if I agree with that again, and I'm not going to repeat your words, but just to add as well, like, you'd want to urge everybody in the Gaelic Games community to take part, because there is an opportunity here to provide that committee with, I suppose, a true reflection, as you said, of what's happening on the ground and the thoughts of the people on the ground and the players. So it is really, really important that everybody who gets the opportunity to take part in this does. And again, it's just tangible progress that we can see, because there has been a little bit, I suppose, of frustration that we haven't seen a whole lot from the Integration Committee, even though we know a lot is going on in the background. But this is really positive, it's tangible, and you'd hope that everybody takes part.
Absolutely. Momentum being the big word, as well, yes, as positivity.
Yes.
Well, so there will be matches this weekend, Aoife, that there is some great news off the pitch, but it is to focus on the pitch as well. There'll be no protests either now after that GPA statement. So we do have the semi-finals of the Camogie Championships on Saturday in Nolan Park, 3:30, Tipperary Waterford, 5:30, Cork versus Galway. Let us start with Cork versus Galway. In a match that, is it a lazy narrative to kind of say, well, whoever wins the championship?
No disrespect, Shane, I think it is. In fairness.
No, listen, hold on now. I'm not saying that's my narrative. I'm playing devil's advocate here, but I'm just posing the questions.
No, that's exactly what you said, Shane.
That's throwing
right?
it out there.
Yeah. Tip and Waterford are listening, right? No, actually, jokingly aside, I'm so happy that I can say I think it is, okay? And I think it is because seeing what Waterford have done this year, seeing what Tipperary have done this year, they've been kind of skirting around that top four for the last number of years. And we discussed it on the show a number of times over the years, is what do they need to do to get onto that next level? And Waterford being back in the semi-final, I think, is a big step for them. And there was no fuss made of them getting there as well. So I think when you're Cork and Galway, you're most certainly not seeing Saturday afternoon as an All-Ireland. And to be fair, whether you're Cork or you're Galway, you've got one big hell of a game to get through. So I'd say neither of them have even thought about the game before them. And I would say Waterford and Tip have not thought about the game after them, which should, I would hope, lead to two absolutely enthralling games, skillful games, but two games where there's going to be a huge lot of fighting, which should be really entertaining.
What's going to be the deciding factor with Cork and Galway? Would you read much into the group match that Galway came out on top?
Oddly, if I was playing back with Cork, I would read a lot into it, because if I'm sitting in the Cork dressing room, I'm looking back at that game, you'd be going, we should have won it. We had the ball enough times. We had enough opportunities. You know, you'd have to look at ourselves there, go, how did we not get over the line? So I think you would actually take a huge amount out of that with Cork. Equally, right, on the other side of this, you'd be Galway going, we didn't actually play that well and we still got over them. So that's why I think it's going to be really intriguing, because you have Cork going, well, we have beaten one of the top three in the last number of years. We after coming out of a real hard game in the quarterfinal in Croke Park against Kilkenny, you would say a huge amount of confidence. It was the first time I actually saw Cork playing with a little bit of grit, a little bit of fight, and a lot more physicality with the ball, which was something I think I critiqued a little bit earlier in the championship. But also the difference between the first game, Cork and Galway, versus how I saw Cork play against Kilkenny, was they started getting the running game in, and the ball into Mackey, into Amy O'Connor, was completely different than how they were playing it earlier in the championship. It was that one bounce pass low to the shin of Amy O'Connor, which is really hard to control her spin if you're marking her. And that Amy O'Connor and Shona Healy is going to be a serious battle. I really hope I hope they get to mark each other, because if you're true to this and you look at the league and you look at the first round, you'd have to go 2-0 to Shona Healy on Amy O'Connor. She needs to have a big game if she can get over Healy, which I'm sure she can, but that is going to be a huge battle. And I think even looking back at the quarter, Mackey had a poor first half, but a poor first half, because I thought Grace Walsh was absolutely outstanding on her. But she kept fighting, and that's what I loved about that quarter final with Cork. The likes of Katrina Mackey kept on fighting, popped the ball over the bar, got a goal in the second half, and came away with a massive effort across that 65 plus minutes. You know, but then you look at Galway, you've got the likes of, she had the likes of Higgins on her, who is an exceptional marker. I think she is probably one of the most underrated defenders in the championship over the last number of years. And Shane, like, it's great to be talking about all these battles, because sometimes we only get a chance to do it once in the year, which is in the final. So I think if you were Cork, you would be reading into that first round, but you'd be taking a huge positive spin from it.
Well, I certainly cannot wait for that. Who is going to come out on top, in your opinion, Aoife, between Tip and Waterford, so in the other semi?
You're getting me to call it straight away.
I'm diving straight in. And you know what? I do apologise that, like, I don't mean to be rushing the on-field stuff in any way, shape or form. And I hope that doesn't come across, because it was huge news with the GPA statement, I think, for both codes. But we're diving straight in. Yeah, you know, will Tip find that strong early noughties form, or will Waterford be able to progress to a historic final? You know, this is, you know, the hard questions, Aoife, putting you on the spot.
I know. But look, isn't it great, right? And I do think, looking back, had a look at a couple of championship games, and I even started back thinking, going, God, would it be a Cork Tip final, like the bringing us back to the noughties again? But looking at both of them and looking how Tip came through that quarter final, I would be verging on the Tipperary side, simply because having that competitive first half, second half, not so much, but they got to hit their stride in Croke Park, which I think they'll take a huge amount of confidence from. You look at Waterford on the other side, Shane, and their last game, a bit like Galway, you know, their last game was the 1st of July, and both teams not having much of a competition. And I think that little bit of lack of, I suppose, championship bite that Tip and Cork got, I would be veering towards an Aussie final of Tip versus Cork in a few weeks' time.
Well, there were some humdingers back then, so here's hoping for more of the same. Aoife Murray, thank you very, very much. Nadine, we're going to finish up by just wrapping up the quarterfinals. And as I mentioned, I do apologise for not getting much game time chat because of the big news off field. So Kerry will play Mayo, Cork will play Dublin in the semi-finals. What was the biggest shock for you, I suppose, from the weekend? Was it the manner of Donegal's defeat with Maxi stepping away then?
Yeah, the defeat, to be honest, Shane, because they did tip them. Bigger shock was the manner of the defeat. Listen, huge credit to Dublin. They were totally up for it. They got their matchups right. Like, young Niamh Crowley on Niamh Hegarty was phenomenal. Ailish O'Dowd really nullified Niamh McLaughlin. All over the pitch, they had huge performances. I mean, Ellen Gribben, I think she's 18 or 19, came off the bench at half time, scored a stunning goal. Tactically, they were very astute, as we would always expect them to be. Physically, clinically, they were just phenomenal, far superior. Donegal just didn't get going. They had no momentum, Shane. They were very lethargic. They really played within themselves, and that's my biggest regret for the girls, because they've just been amazing for us, for the county. And yeah, Maxi stepped away. Listen, I was talking to him there yesterday, and just, you know, to say that he has been a massive influence on Donegal football over the last 20 years. I played under Maxi in 03, and he's one of the most innovative coaches I've ever met with. And while me and him would have clashed now in the recent years over our style of football, well, everything Maxi did for Donegal came from the heart, and he's just a great guy, and I wish him the very, very best. It's definitely, we haven't seen the last of him.
Okay, well, we will talk about it in detail when we're previewing the semi-finals. We haven't even got around to talking to Vicky Wall's move to Sevens Rugby, but we will get to that in due course. Just before we go, as I mentioned at the start of the show, we have live commentary tomorrow on 2FM. Marie is going to be on air from 10:30. Adrian Eames is our man on the ground who can set the scene for us now to wrap up on World Cup Eve.
Well, Shane, Mass will be earlier in the morning in Amber Barrett's home place at Milford. That's to allow parishioners get home in time to watch or indeed listen as Ireland make their first appearance at a World Cup finals. Kickoff 11 o'clock Irish time, and of course it's live on a Game On special. The Irish not without a prayer tomorrow, but they face a very tough task against an Australian side spearheaded by the highly talented Sam Kerr of Chelsea. But as Vera Powell rightly pointed out today, Kerr is not the only threat in the Matildas' armoury. Make no mistake, there's huge pressure on the co-host. One commentator on the game here predicted a 4-0 win for Australia. Denise O'Sullivan has been past fit for Ireland. She scored 6 goals in qualifying. Ireland's final 3 games in qualifying all resulted in 1-0 wins against Finland, Slovakia, and of course famously in Scotland, when Milford's own Amber Barrett wrote herself into the history books. A victory, 1-0 or otherwise, tomorrow would be absolutely mighty. There were heartwarming scenes at Sydney Airport today as fans turned out to greet the Irish team following their arrival from Brisbane, and the suggestions are that Ireland will not lack for support inside a packed Stadium Australia tomorrow.
Sinead, that is all we have time for. So from all of the Game On team, it is bye for now. Marie's back at 10:30. I'll talk to you at 6. Benedict Silva is up next, the very talented and indeed patient